At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
Show me the money!
My name is Jared, and with me today is Ryan.
Hey, film fans.
And Austin.
Yo.
All right, so one thing got to say up top here. Austin is having some microphone issues, so actually we're hearing him today through his Apple earbud things. So not the most ideal situation, but we're going to do the best we can.
Mea culpa.
Yeah, it just was a last-minute technical difficulty, and so we'll do better next time. So sorry about that, guys. But also wanted to have a couple other announcements. So, one, I want to congratulate our boy Austin because he just got a book deal.
Woo!
Oh, thank you.
Hell yeah,
man. So tell us what's going on. What's the book about? And when can we see it on the shelves?
Oh, gosh. So it's called Creating Society as a Work of Art, and it proceeds in two stages. So the first is my sort of fresh reinterpretation of a very obscure text by Jean-Paul Sartre that, you know, he's known for being like the existentialist, and people kind of associate him with being a nihilist and talking about human freedom and kind of creating meaning in a world that doesn't have objective meaning. But in his later life, he started theorizing about trying to bridge that idea together with sort of political concerns and social concerns about how it is that we can have group freedom. And he stops thinking about like hell is other people and all of these famous things that he's kind of known for. And he starts thinking about whether or not it's possible to have intersubjective relations and why it is that conflict and strife settle into groups and communities even after like moments of revolutionary freedom or after moments of solidarity. Why is it that bureaucracy settles in, and why is it that we inevitably fall into institutions, and why is it that Supreme Court justice nominee hearings go shit shows, you know, like that sort of thing. And he kind of develops a framework for analyzing that. And I think that everybody who's ever read his text basically has missed something. And so I'm trying to argue for a fresh way of how to use the imagination as being an integral part towards our analysis of analyzing social systems so that we can unpack them, find out where we went wrong in our creation of those social systems, and then rebuild them afresh with a better lens.
Yeah. So the first part
is all theoretical, and then the second part, it tries to be much more practical. And I look at the imagination, and then I look at kind of contemporary struggles in politics and try to argue how it is that we can apply this framework of thinking to our own issues today.
Sounds cool. Good luck writing it, my friend.
Thank you.
Yeah, one other thing I want to announce. So we just started something really cool on our South Park podcast. It is a voicemail service. So if you want to give us a call, leave us a voicemail. We, you know, on top of doing mailbag, where we will read your emails with your comments, questions, insights, we'll also have you guys leave us messages, and then we'll play it on the podcast.
The funnier, the better.
The funnier, the better. But also, the more insightful, the better. Or
oh, yeah,
just
that
a question, all yeah. sorts of stuff. Just if you want to tell Ryan that his voice sounds fat, if you want to tell me I'm too meta, if you want to tell Austin that he wanks off with his intellectualism too much, all of that is up for grabs. So give us a call at 213-534-8807. Once again, that's 213-534-8807. And
got some new sound effects today, trying out, everybody.
Yeah. Also, last thing, me and Ryan are doing a Wisecrack live Halloween show October 26th at 10 p.m. in L.A. with the guys from Funhouse. So Adam Kovic and company, details to come. But without further ado, today we're talking about John Wick 2, directed by Chad Stahelski, starring Keanu Reeves. As always, let's get some first impressions. Tell me what you think about this movie, Ryan.
Well, I wasn't here for
that
your...
That sounded like a challenge. That was like a John Wick challenge.
It's like, how do you summarize your love for John Wick? I mean, it's, yeah, man's dog gets killed, man shoots everyone he sees that had anything to do with it, the end.
Well, the first movie.
I know, and so I'm saying I wasn't here for the first movie, so I just love the concept of John Wick. You know, I love genre movies, I love shoot 'em up action movies, so this is like, I think the best one we got going today. You know, like if, yeah. If the Raid was, you know, did for movies what, you know, like the Raid was the best martial arts movie, you know, that you couldn't touch. And then this is like yeah. your best just like
if the Raid
shoot 'em up movie.
If the Raid made as much money as the John Wick series.
Yes.
And I mean, the Raid 3
it got popular.
The Raid 3 isn't even being worked on right now.
Right.
It's still going to happen one day, hopefully. Done. But yeah. John Wick 3 is already done shooting. It's coming out in 2019. Super excited for it, but yeah.
In terms of John Wick 2, I would say, I mean, it is very similar to the first, I feel like. Mm-hmm. You know, it, I mean, it does open up the world a little bit more of how the underworld there works. I love how the fact that pretty much it seems like everyone is an assassin just sitting on the street. Anybody? Like, you know, everyone walking around, which
everyone
I think is hilarious,
phone,
and
yeah.
no one just knows it. So yeah, I, overall great. I like seeing people get shot in the head, but did it really do more than the first? No, but did it need to? So that's my review.
Fair question. What about you, Austin?
Yeah. So first time I saw it, I actually fell asleep while I was watching it. Cause I don't know if it was just, I wasn't digging it or what, but, so the second time I watched it was last night in preparation for this. And listen, I love the first John Wick. And I feel like the way that I had to get into the second John Wick was by remembering, like, explicitly that this is all just continuing from them killing his dog and stealing his car. That was how I could, like, enjoy his rampage. Otherwise, I feel like as a standalone movie, you know how sometimes sequels can kind of function a little bit detached from the first one? Like, yeah, they're sequels. And they're somehow related, but they're still a little bit detached. For me, this one only works if you just keep it in mind that this is still like the same sequence of events. And you have to really make sure that you're like, yeah, this is still all part of it. This is a 4-hour long movie, basically.
It is it's funny. Just,
there's a yeah. long intermission.
We talked about this in our John Wick 1 podcast, but it's funny how even Ryan, when summarizing what John Wick 1 is, he doesn't even mention the wife, which, as Austin pointed out, is that the dog is simply just a symbol of transference for his pain about his wife dying, but right. nobody remembers that. It's just that you fuck with my dog, I will burn you to the ground.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, I actually think the second one is like, it's not, I don't think it's quite as good because I feel like as a film, it just doesn't have as much story, right? Like,
really?
Because the story, the setup is all in the first one.
That's not true. I mean, only in that you could say the first one is about a guy trying to retire and then he gets pulled back in. And then he gets pulled back in this time, but for different reasons and for reasons that are a continuation of things that are hinted at in the first one. This whole idea that he had to make a deal with this guy Santino that allowed him to, quote, yeah. get out the first time. So I think that more so than the dog dying, the common trend is that John Wick is a guy who wants to retire and wants to live a peaceful life. But
gets
as Al Pacino said, gets sucked back in.
You kind of see that story a lot, right? And so
you do.
But the guy going on a rampage because you killed his dog because the dog is the sort of emblem of his dead wife, like that shit's that is I don't know. It just had an originality to it that obviously is hard to sustain in a sequel. That's the only thing. I mean, I still like the fucking movie. It's a good movie, but I'm trying to be critical here.
I really, if I had one complaint about this movie, and Jerry, you're gonna hate this, but I wish that the second dog had been killed. I mean,
no, fuck you.
You just like Austin just said, you know, like you got to keep the first dog in mind, but there's a second dog. It's like Chekhov's gun. This is Chekhov's dog that we have in John Wick 2. If you see the dog in the first act of the movie,
the
he better be dead
to
by
die.
The
no,
better
he
be dead by
to,
the end in John
in
Wick 2.
The third movie, I think the dog is going to like kick ass with him. I mean, that's what I want to see. I want to see. I mean, I don't think the dog is going to have a gun with a silencer, but I think the dog will at least like bite somebody, you know, at a crucial moment when John Wick, his safety is compromised and the dog comes in and saves the day. Well, that's what I want to see.
Yeah, I do too. And just you mentioned the silencer. The silencer battle in the train station is hilarious when they're like shooting each other.
Yes, yes.
Like just trying to silently
yes,
shoot each other.
Yes.
There's a lot of really good, like action comedy in this movie,
yeah,
more
actually,
than the first one. So if I had to, yeah, I think that I'm glad you brought that up, or I brought that up.
I'm glad you brought that up too, because that's my first talking point is about humor
yeah.
in this movie, which I think is what makes it so successful. I mean, obviously what makes it successful is the amazing fight choreography, all of the action, all that stuff. But things like that get too heavy and too serious if you don't balance it out with a little bit of comedy.
Amen, baby.
And, you know, not necessarily in the Marvel way. I mean, the Marvel movies do it,
I love how
in their own very effective way. But I think this does it in a. I mean, I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying that this one does it in a bit more of a subtle way. That's pretty interesting. Anyway,
why is it? Do you think that sequels tend to go that route more than originals do? Like sometimes the original. I'm trying to think of other examples, and I can't right now.
Well, I think
but the original will
come
out and there's less comedy, and then the sequels come out and they up the comedy, they up the winks and the nods to the audience. Is it because you just can't maintain like
I think,
a level
you think
of
in this
comedy
case,
or
in this
something?
Case with multiple facets, they just lean into what works.
You think that's it? Yeah,
with all the world building. And the ways that we discussed in the first one and the way that they'll use kind of cryptic dialogue to hint at a greater world in which we fill in the blanks, that's done even more so this time. The comedy is leaned into more. I just think that
they bring in Morpheus and Neo to have a reunion.
Oh, yeah, the Morpheus-Neo reunion. That's pretty cool. Although, I don't know. I kind of feel like Lawrence Fishburne overacted a little bit in this one. He's like, somebody get this man a gun. Anyway, I love this movie. This is one of my favorite series that's currently going on right now. I love Keanu Reeves. I love the action. I mean, you brought up The Raid earlier. Something very dear to my heart is practical action choreography. Yeah. And I just, you know, I love going into a movie and knowing that it's not just a bunch of Hollywood models against a green screen emoting on cue.
I was in pain watching this movie at some parts. I mean, you can't, you know that even the stunts... That like the stunts hurt, you know.
Oh yeah, Keanu Reeves got hurt in the filming of the third one. It was a publicized thing. I mean, I don't think he's
the second one. You mean?
No, the third one that just finished wrapping a couple months ago.
The one with him on a horse shooting a guy in the head on a motorcycle.
Yeah, exactly. All right, cool. So I love this movie. I really have not much except praise for it. I'm not like super critical. I'm not expecting something hugely profound, but I think that there's a lot of things that you can appreciate about this movie as to why it works as well as it does. So we're mostly going to be talking about that today. But without further ado, let's go into a recap.
Shortest recap ever.
It's pretty short. Not long after the conclusion of John Wick Chapter 1 finds John trying to tie up loose ends, recovering his car, and establishing peace with the remaining Russian crime family. Unfortunately, another attempt at retirement is cut short when a mysterious acquaintance named Santino shows up and presents John with a marker. Bound by the marker to do whatever favor Santino asks, John is tasked with killing Santino's sister in order to consolidate Santino's power in his crime family. Seeing it as the only way to escape once again, John heads to Rome, gears up, and confronts Santino's sister, who, when faced with the inevitable, kills herself to end things on her own terms. Santino crosses John when he sends mercenaries to avenge his sister's murder. Now John has to kill dozens of assassins on his way to kill Santino. With the entire world's community of assassins after him, John is forced to request the help of the Bowery King, who arms him and points him into the direction of Santino. John pursues Santino through a modern art exhibit, piling bodies along the way until he catches up with him at the Continental. John breaks one of the two cardinal rules of the Continental and kills Santino on safe ground, excommunicating him and forfeiting his life. The manager warns him that he has 1 hour before the entire criminal underground will be after him. So John flees into the city, his dog at his side. End of movie.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
So the first thing I want to bring up that Ryan already hinted at is humor. And I want to ask you guys, do you guys remember, it's not the first shot of the movie, but it's basically the first thing we see that's not just the cityscapes. It's technically the fourth shot of the movie. But do you guys know what I'm referencing?
Give me a little more.
Okay. Something is being projected on the side of a building before we pan down.
Yeah.
We tilt down and see a motorcycle being like hit by a car or something.
Right, yeah.
It's like a Buster Keaton movie.
Right. It's like some old-timey 1920s movie, and it's like the exact same stunt that we see like right under it a second later.
Yeah, I had not noticed this any other time I'd watched the movie, but I found it really interesting.
Notice that? It takes up the whole shot.
I mean, I don't remember it.
Okay, gotcha.
And I didn't consider its why it's meaningful. I really think it sets the tone of the movie's awareness of its comedy, because we see a Buster Keaton movie projected on the side of a building, which, first of all, where do you see that happening? I never see that. Where does this movie take place? Is it New York? Is it?
I feel like it's New York.
Well, I mean, at least it's New York at the very end. He doesn't like go anywhere else, right? But it's definitely New York.
Well, he goes to Rome.
He's in Central Park.
Yeah, he goes to Rome. I've seen stuff projected on the side of buildings before, but I mean, it is a strange, weird choice and a strong one to begin a movie with.
Yeah, it's a strong choice, and it's interesting how the crashes that we hear happening with John chasing the guy on the motorcycle is in sync with the Buster Keaton clashes and stuff, which I thought.
So you think that was like their signal that like this is going to be a comedy version of John Wick? Kind
of. No, I don't think it's any more of a comedy version than the first one. I just think that.
I do. There's a ton of comedy in this movie. There's a lot of scenes. It's like Jackie Chan movies, you know, where it's just like. It's like you get kind of bored of watching people just hit each other, so then he finds funny ways to do it. And it's,
but that's present in the
first
one.
And Jackie Chan says that his hero is Buster Keaton.
Right.
Like, he's. I mean, I think I didn't know this until many years later. I thought that Jackie Chan was just like a martial arts Jean-Claude Van Damme type.
No
but,
way, man.
You know, doing his own thing, coming over from China. No, he's a physical comedian, or he's a physical performer, physical comedian. So all of his stunts and things, he views himself in the lineage of Buster Keaton. And that this film ties that in as well is, I think, kind of trying to say we are also participating in that same lineage. That's fucking cool.
Yeah. No, but Jackie Chan is the man. But
oh, yeah, dude.
But even in the first one we talked about in our last podcast, there were times where he shoots a guy in the stomach, the guy's writhing in pain, and he takes the time to reload and then shoots him in the head. We see something similar happen in this
one. For sure, there's comedy present in both. But to me, there's like entire comedy sequences. Like that one where there's using silencers in a crowded train station, that is a full-on comedy scene, you know?
Yes.
And then there's just a ton of moments like that with the homeless guy, you know, and all the homeless assassins. You know, there's just really funny moments like that throughout the whole thing, and I think that was definitely a conscious choice. So, like, how far can we take the operatic comedy of killing people with silencers?
And you headshots. Get to actually see him kill two people with a pencil.
Oh yeah, that was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I loved when he held it against the wall and then he just pushes the guy's head into the back of it.
Oh yeah.
It's amazing. But the thing is you ask most people to think about John Wick, they wouldn't call it a comedy. They would call it a straight action movie. But I really think that the reason why a movie like this can succeed at the level that it does is it undercuts its very dire sincerity. Because you just can't have that kind of morose seriousness uninterrupted throughout a whole movie.
Well, what's so awesome about the comedy in this movie is that like you're saying, everybody is very serious. No one ever says a quote-unquote joke verbally.
Right.
It's all you're funny from the situation, the context of the situation with all these super deadly serious assassins. And then the whole comedy also coming from just how there are rules to the assassin game. You know, it's like these people who are literally kill people for a living, but you know, that's like comedy. That's a whole comedic setup, but no, everyone is deadpan. Like, you know, you're breaking the rules to our killer club right now. You know, like that's
right.
Funny.
Well, and they also know who John Wick is. So I love that bit at the end when he gives him time, when Ian McShane gives him time, because it's clearly like saying, all right, we're going to cause shit to go crazy in New York City because we have an open hit on you. We've already seen the chaos that you've caused. It's almost like they're giving license for chaos to ensue. You know? They're like, yeah, fuck it.
Well, we're which is why I think the ending of this movie is so exciting for the third one, is because we do see these first two movies that are built upon this world with very strict rules that people treat with the utmost reverence, and now at the end of the second movie, it's like, well, guess what? All the rules are out the window because you are excommunicado, and the whole fucking world is after you. What a cliffhanger! it's not like a cliffhanger as to like, oh man, I can't believe they didn't reveal something essential to the conflict of the movie that we just watched. But if it's a cliffhanger in that, wow, we're about to see, you know, what happens when the rules break down of this very civilized and very gentlemanly group of killers.
Yeah.
So there's some lines I want to read that are callbacks to the first movie, and a lot of this is in the opening scene. So I love in the opening scene the two guys, the brother of the Russian mobster from the first one, is talking to, I guess, his assistant or something like that. And he says, why is this happening? Because my nephew killed a fucking dog and stole his car, a car which is currently among our inventory. So we're giving everything up just for a car. It's not just a car. It's John Wick's car. And then he just goes, oh. And everybody just, and that's
enough
the exact
said.
Enough said. You don't have to say anything more. It's just that same thing happened with the Russian mob boss from the first one, is when John Leguizamo tells him because he killed John Wick's dog and stole his car, and he's just like, oh. And then I love they do kind of restate the whole monologue about John Wick being a man of focus, commitment. Except this time they cut him off. He says, and sheer fucking will, he once killed three men in a bar with a pencil. I know, I've heard the story. And the other guy's like, with a fucking pencil? Who the fuck can do that? So funny. And then after that, when John Wick is coming, so now the Russian mobster's by himself, drinking a drink, scared shitless, and you just hear in the distance people getting their skulls cracked and all this violence happening, then in comes Keanu Reeves. You know, it's like what you don't show almost that creates the comedy here.
Mm.
Yeah. And the legend.
The legend.
John Wick.
He is a legend.
Who's another,
for sure.
I feel like that's been in movie history before. The one that comes off my head is like Unusual Suspects with Kaiser Soze. Just there's this mysterious.
You mean The Usual Suspects?
Yeah, what did I just say?
You said Unusual.
Oh, yeah. Usual Suspects. But yeah, you know what I'm saying? And then maybe like the Man with No Name series, kind of just like there's things unsaid about his past, about how he became this person.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really ever tell you, but it creates this legend.
There's actually a small detail in this movie that I think works to what you're saying here that I think is really interesting. So this is when Common's character... Who the
yes.
fuck knew he could kick ass? That's crazy. Common's character goes down to the subway where they're about to meet, like, they're about to fight for their final fight where Keanu kills him by sticking the knife in his heart. And oftentimes in noir movies and action movies, we see a villain and we see a train pass the villain's point of, or we see the train pass the audience's point of view, and usually it obscures the villain and then he's, like, gone or something. And it's always meant to give this air of mystery to the villain as to kind of heighten his, heighten our fear of this guy. But interestingly, in that scene, we're in Common's point of view, and then we see the train pass and Keanu Reeves disappears. And so it's interesting how this movie, that all the badass mythology, it's not building up the villains. We all know that the villains can't stand a chance against John Wick.
Right.
But still, it works somehow. Right?
Yeah, absolutely works. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that moment because my whole life, I feel like as a spectator of movies and now as an editor, like that moment when people just disappear, like, you know, it's like, oh, and one more thing. Oh, and then the person's just gone.
Right.
It's always like, what the fuck? That's bullshit. No one can just walk away like silently. Mm-hmm. Even ninjas, you know, if you're right next to them.
Yeah.
It works in this movie because it's a fucking movie. But yeah. It's just, I love it.
Yeah, and there's something that was so nice about it, too. Not only does John Wick disappear, but he disappears, and then you get a gap, supposedly, in between the trains where you see him walking to his, I guess, to his left and to our screen right. And again, it is playing with the expectation that he would just, like, disappear into the night like a ninja. But he doesn't. He slowly just walks down the platform a little bit, and then he gets on the train, which is, how did they both get on the same train? Because usually at train stations, you don't get on at both sides. But yeah, which is a strange thing. So it is weird how you can't get people on the train. But whatever. But the point is that it's just a really nice little sequence of playing, like you said, with the audience's expectations, and then a nice kind of sequence of editing and whatnot that show that different perspective. But I don't know why, but for some reason, that shot of getting a glimpse of him, like walking. Whereas normally the train comes and then all of a sudden the guy's disappeared, right? But this one, they give you that little glimpse of, no, we're not going to kind of go that same route. And you see him walking. And then all of a sudden you know that John Wick is still on the other side of that train. And that was kind of a nice little filmmaking tactic, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. All right, guys, you want to talk about world building? I think this is the thing that is most impressive about the first one and also about the second one.
Oh, yeah. This is what makes the movies, man.
Absolutely. What's your favorite element that we were introduced to in this one?
Oh, absolutely what Ryan said. I just love how everyone's a fucking assassin.
Yeah. You know what my, you know what my favorite scene is? The sommelier. You know what I'm talking about? The sommelier is the gun dude. The gun dude.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the most sensual scene in the film. There's a part where the guy is describing a shotgun and he says, it has textured grips, should your hands get, and then he like pauses for a second and says, wet. It's almost like they were flirting in that scene. And I found that scene to be really awesome because it was also like super, I found it to be really subversive in a time where everyone is very critical about guns and guns as a hot topic control, just to see these two men just geeking out and fetishizing these weapons, I thought was
fucking
awesome.
Well, you're from
awesome.
Texas, right?
I'm from Texas. I know how to fetishize a good gun.
I know. I was going to say, you're from a place where people walk around with the gun on their hip when they're in Starbucks, right?
I never really saw that much. I mean, I had some, more than anything, growing up in Texas, you meet a lot of people who grow up and go into the military. I don't know anybody who's in the military in L.A. or who has, I guess I just don't know young people with aspirations, or I don't know people who have come back from the military. But I grew up with a bunch of kids who were obsessed with going into the military. And so, you know, they would read things like Guns and Ammo, and they would be really excited about, you know, airsoft guns and stuff like that. So, yeah,
it's just not as common in L.A., man. The L.A. culture is more skinny jeans, and I want to start my own clothing line rather than I want to go and fight and carry a gun, you know?
The whole blood oath kind of like really getting into like what a blood oath means for these people and how seriously they take that was pretty cool, you know, because that's kind of a universal thing. Even kids can relate to that. You're gonna go back on a oath. You promise. You swore.
Yeah,
that means a lot. Even though we're murderers and we break every law that's on the books, you better not break this oath. I see your blood here.
I mentioned this in the John Wick 1 podcast. The way that this movie starts, the way that it's brought back in, is awesome. He just takes this medallion, sets it on the table, and then says, I do this with a heavy heart. A marker is no small thing, John. For a man to give another man a marker is to bind a soul with a blood oath. And it's one line of exposition, and we get it immediately. Because just like you said, we know what a blood oath is, and we see immediately how this man could get pulled back in, even though he just killed the entire New York Russian mob.
And honestly, it kind of made me, in a very strange way, not sympathize with John Wick as much whenever he said, you know what, man, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I know it's a blood oath, but I'm not going to do it. It's like, dude, John, you made a blood oath with this person.
Well,
what
he
is
gets
wrong
his
with
fucking
you?
House blown
well,
up.
Well, right,
so.
But it's kind of like, well, yeah, I have way less. You know, the dog thing came out of nowhere in the first one with, you know, some asshole. And then, yeah, I can see him wanting to have a day of reckoning. This was like, we told you, we warned you, we came to your house, you gave a blood oath, you're going back on it. We're gonna burn everything down. I mean, I have less sympathy for him in this one.
Well, but it is ultimately, Santino is the bad guy because he crosses John and just throws him under the bus and says, yeah, people are telling me my sister died, so what am I supposed to do? I'm her brother. Obviously, I got to go tell the entire criminal underground to go kill John Wick.
Well,
so,
right.
So that's why, I mean, that's the whole second act. I mean, the first act you would think like, okay, so he gets the marker,
yeah, at
he
that
goes
point,
and kills the woman, you know, then he can go back to being dog dad.
Well, right, because then at that point, Santino has gone back on the gone back of the blood oath, you know, so.
Well, he hasn't gone back on the blood oath. He's just a dick afterwards.
Well, right. Or it's just rules within rules, right? Because the rule is, okay, you've got this blood oath, you have to be faithful to that. But then at the same time, if someone kills your family, you have to avenge them because that's just what you do. So obviously, it's like, it's just like this paradox, these points of contradiction. Yeah. You got to just fucking keep going along with the rules.
Blood
man.
Before blood oath.
What do you expect is going to happen?
Right. Yeah. I also love how this whole thing with the markers contextualized that this is the thing that allowed you to achieve the night of your impossible task. We don't know the details of how Santino helped him, but we get from the first one that this impossible task is how he put the Russian mobster from the first one into power and ultimately how he got out of the mob. So I think it's interesting how the fact that he was able to even have that brief life with his wife is only because of this marker, and that's one of the things that comes back to haunt him.
So they don't really explain the marker too much. They kind of hint at it, but what exactly is the marker?
Well, all we know is that it's there's two sides of it. Both of them have space for a bloody thumbprint, and if basically it's like the most epic IOU of all time.
It's like Blood Brothers for
it's
real.
Like I may come. It's like I may come to you. What I'm trying to do a Don Corleone impression. It's like I will give you any favor on the day of my daughter's wedding, and then one day.
But one day I come to you. One day when I come for you, ask you a favor. You better be there in return.
You're doing all right.
What, Jared? I come for you next.
All right. So another really cool thing. I don't think any of us are very good at impressions.
I am, Jared.
The Bowery King. Let's talk about Lawrence Fishburne. I love how Keanu Reeves just walks up to this homeless guy and just says, take me to him, tell him it's John Wick. And then already our minds are firing off into, oh, okay, so now there's a whole underworld behind homeless people now. Yeah. And then it turns out you think that, okay, he's just going to hide him, but nope, this homeless guy who's supposedly begging for change, the two guys chasing John Wick come up to him, and the guy just whips out a silencer and just headshots both of them. And you're just like, what the fuck?
That's
it's so amazing. I love how they...
Well, and they were cops, weren't they?
I think they were cops, yeah.
I think they're cops, and he shoots them. And then these two other goons come out, and then they drag the cops away.
Right, yeah. Super efficient. Super efficient.
Well, it's just crazy. It makes me think that in the third one, are they going to build this out even further so that... Taxi drivers, they're a part of it. And
yes.
Soccer moms, they're a part of it. Like, everyone.
I like how they have this really interesting thing with, like, high class, low class. So it's either a high class sommelier who also sells guns, or, like, an expensive Italian suit vendor who also sells bulletproof vests or puts them inside the suits. Or it's a homeless population who controls an underground arms market. Or, like, they have the Hasidic bankers in the hood who have some sort of understanding with the mob. So my question is, if we take this high-class, low-class thing, what other underworlds would there be in John Wick 3? So I want to ask you guys, what do you think?
I mean, I think that since he's going to be it's going to be John Wick on the run, you know? I think that there's going to be lots of, like, maybe his airplane pilot, maybe his, you know, bus driver.
See, I think it's going to be like, so another thing is that I really like how Santino's character is always associated with, like, modern art. The last shootout scene happens in a modern art exhibit. You know, it's
like
interesting.
House of Mirrors.
Yeah, this world is so gentlemanly. I think that this franchise is actually more similar to James Bond than probably most people would think, because it's very gentlemanly. It's not shaken, not stirred martini or whatever James Bond has, but, you know, there's that awesome part where Common and Keanu Reeves get thrown through the glass door, and then they're at the Continental, so they have to be civil to each other. And he says, it's scotch, right? It's bourbon, right? Or I think it was gin, but you know what I'm saying. So one of the underworlds, I think that maybe in the same vein, like maybe the opera house or something, or like the opera singers will sell armed car stuff, or that like a really cheap buffet in Chinatown or something will secretly have explosives in the back. Or,
well, I love that the mom with the stroller, you know, the fact that that person's an assassin means literally anybody, you know, because...
Or the woman playing violin in the subway.
Right. So, I think that it's going to be one of the... That's going to be where the comedy comes from a lot in the third one, is just who the fuck turns out to be an assassin.
Right.
You know, which... Honestly, I love it. I love that idea so much. But if you take it to its logical conclusion, it's like, so these homeless people are assassins. I assume they make a lot of money and they have all these guns and stuff, but they spend all their days just like, are they in costume or are they actually homeless?
They're homeless 9 to 5. Okay. And then they go home to their families.
So they go to a home.
They go to a mansion.
You don't
believe
that the homeless assassins sleep in the subway and are actually Daniel Day-Lewis style. 24/7 with sniper rifles.
I'm
underneath.
Mostly joking.
They're method assassins.
I don't know. That's a good question. What motivates? Because obviously they probably sell these guns for money,
right?
So why? I don't know. What do you think, Austin?
Well, yeah, and then remember the operation that they're running on the rooftop with the pigeons has something to do with microchips. So and they're sending that shit all over the place, right? So they're obviously making shitloads of money somehow through carrier pigeon.
Yeah, and then even apparently they have enough money to turn down the $7 million they would have gotten from turning John Wick in.
Right, right. So, which, by the way, interesting fact, apparently a pigeon was just discovered with like shitloads of, I think it was ecstasy pills or something like that, in a little backpack in his on his back. just recently. So I just read this news story, and then I watched this film. I was like, oh, I guess that shit does really happen.
Wow.
You know, I bet you in the future there's going to be lots of drug deals done with drones.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably, I mean, why not right now? I'm sure that shit happens right now.
In the future, there's going to be hundreds of them so you can blend in better, you know? It's probably easier to see a fucking ounce of weed.
Yeah, but if you're a cop, you can't pull over a drone.
You can sure find
it. Yeah, I always wonder, how did they find this pigeon? They must have known about it, and then they went to the place, like, is it a coop? I don't know what you call a fucking pigeon, a little nest thing on a roof. They must have known about it, and then gone into that place and found it. Because how the fuck are you going to identify the single pigeon that has a backpack filled with ecstasy pills?
Good question. But I think there's going to be, in the third one, there's going to be like cheap knockoff watches in Chinatown are actually weaponized watches or something like that.
In the comments,
that's actually a good guess.
In the comment section, Melanin Monster said they had a locker room for homeless clothes members.
That's right. They totally did. There was a whole locker room setup where you also saw the guns. So,
yeah.
I mean, it might be just a character they're playing. Yeah, it might be a hiding in plain sight kind of operation.
Yeah, it's like, hey, if we need an insider on the subway, we know to call that assassin, you know, because they're the ones playing the homeless person this
year. So here's my question. How are these fuckers getting funded? Like, where's this money coming from?
Well, they're selling guns.
They're selling guns and they're selling hits.
Yeah, so then there's got to be – contracts. This just like – so who's hiring the assassins?
Rich people.
The mobs, rich people. Various mobs.
Okay, and the mobs. So
bad
it's,
guys.
It's all – like I'm wondering, do you think it'll step up to the national level? Like somehow governments are involved in the next one.
It's a good question. Where is John Wick going to try to hide? Is he going to try to hide at all, or is he just going to at the beginning of the movie say, well, it looks like I'm going to have to take down every criminal organization –
I can totally
planet.
See them going that big and being like, all of a sudden, like, there's the president, you know, who all of a sudden gets a call from one of the people and's like, damn it, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
All right, I'll give all the resources of the United States government to get John Wick because I'm a part of this clan, you know?
And I got elected. I think that would be almost – I think that would break it. If it was, would be too, if it went
jump
that
the shark,
high, it would jump the shark. Shark, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I would like it.
So maybe, like, right up to that point. Yeah, I wonder that. Because it is kind of fun thinking that this is some sort of black market world that exists as the underbelly. But now that they're building it out, they're almost normalizing it a little. Almost to the point of like, okay, is this the point of its contradiction? Like it can't get any bigger than this. We already think that like the violinist in the subway tunnel is a fucking assassin. So too is my Uber driver, right? So how far does this go? Is everybody just a part of a different gang? Like some people are assassins, some people make bulletproof vests. If you're a graphic designer, you make websites that are actually like covers for hacking, you know? I mean, like you're actually a hacker, but you do graph. It's like working in Hollywood.
All the elementary,
everyone in Hollywood works for the entertainment industry. So even if you're like a fucking graphic designer, you make some stuff for the local bank down the road, but most of the time you're trying to work for some sort of TV studio or something like that.
I think that chances are they're going to reveal some other faction of the underground criminal world, and it's going to be one that's not associated with the Continental. That I think that there's always going to be the thing in John Wick where John gets into a bad situation and he has to take refuge into some sort of underground world that he's aware of, that he's introducing the audience to. I think that's still going to be a pretty big factor in the third one. Because they could just keep building whatever they want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your next thing you got on there?
So I wanted to talk more about this idea. In the last one, we talked about the idea of memifying actors.
Yeah.
And how Keanu Reeves – in the last one, we were talking about the fact that it's funnier because we all think of Keanu Reeves as Ted from Bill and Ted or from the surfer guy from – what was the one with him?
Point Break.
And then
or sad Keanu on the bench.
Well, I think sad Keanu is the one that really came to mind this time, and how like he's almost like the sad Keanu version of James Bond, because just like the real sad Keanu meme, because the sad Keanu thing is that like he has a tragic life because his sister died of cancer. What were the other sad things
a wife and child both passed away.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have John Wick has a similarly tragic situation where he's always thinking about his wife, but. There's also something else. Did you guys pick up, maybe I'm overthinking this, but did you guys pick up at all that Santino's sister and John were perhaps once lovers?
I kind of got that feeling that they definitely had a past.
Yeah. And but it's never said explicitly, but there's a part where she gets like so close to him, like she's almost seducing him, even though it's not like a seduction that she's trying to get anything from him. She knows that John Wick is here. He is a man of sheer will. I am going to die. But she gets so close. And then, of course, she gets naked. But there's something about this in how when you think of James Bond, he's like the ascetic James Bond, where he never actually – you think of James Bond, he's always getting the women. He's always got the drinks. But all these things are contextualized in a very negative fashion. We see John Wick interact with people that he had a past with. Even in the first one, there was like that woman at the bar who's like, oh, Jonathan, it's good to see you. And there's kind of a hint that maybe they had something. And then there's the woman who tries to kill him that Greg was saying he thought that maybe they had banged before. So it's like he's just as suave as James Bond, but he's the broken James Bond who we never actually get to see him revel in any of the really awesome things that most spy badass gun wielding dudes get to partake in.
Totally. And you know, James Bond, it's funny because if you really like, James Bond should be broken. I mean, he's had so many fucking women he's loved, you know, turn out to either backstab him or get killed by his villains and stuff. But, you know, he just keeps going on and drinking his martinis and from movie to movie.
Well, that's why Casino Royale is so fucking amazing, is because it actually gives you a little bit of reason to think that James Bond isn't a sociopath.
Right.
Yeah. It's something, you know, Austin has done some work with us on a couple of videos. We've done a couple of videos now where we talk about this idea of the post-Western. I think this is like the James Bond post-Western.
This is the post-James Bond, James Bond movie.
I was thinking that. Yeah, there's like the gold gunslinger gets drawn back into it after he's retired, and there is that sort of like revisionist Western, Unforgiven sort of mood here as well.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And another thing that connects us more with the James Bond aesthetic is that everything is so gentlemanly. I mentioned earlier with Keanu and Common going through the glass window and it was like, gin, was it? Yes, bourbon, right? And then I mentioned earlier Santino's father has this amazing art collection. And I really like how every time we see Santino, he is the bad guy, just a real fucking scumbag that we all hate, but he's always framed at museums against the backdrop of either really, really nice paintings or like Greco-Roman statues. That's something that, and this is going to sound really wanky, but that's something that Kubrick often does, is he kind of takes really violent, horrible scenarios or people and contrasts them with like high art and high culture. And it's always been something that, and I think his point was that culture is not necessarily a sign of moral elevation. I don't think that's quite the point being made here, but I do think that it's really interesting, it's effective, and I really like how the criminal underworld here is just as buttoned up, just as gentlemanly, and just as suave as the world of James Bond.
Do you think that juxtaposes with the sad Keanu meme thing? Like, how do you think that fits into this? Does the sad Keanu meme somehow like enter into these familiar themes and take us out of it? Does it add something extra to it? Like, what makes you think about the memification element?
Well, I think that it adds to the comedy. Before we were talking about, and I mentioned this a couple minutes ago, is that it's funny because we see Ted from Bill and Ted, you know, headshotting 100 people in a minute. But now I'm starting to think that maybe a probably more apt way to describe that is that sad Keanu is tired of being sad and wants to take out his sadness by headshotting thousands of people in 1 minute. I don't know. What do you think?
The humor bit is maybe the one bit, and maybe I'm just a no fun douchebag right now or something, but the humor is the one bit that I don't love so much.
Boo!
Or at least certain elements, like the Morpheus bit. When Lawrence Fishburne comes in, I kind of was like, of course. But then
I don't really like
it. It was like a moment. I got a moment of joy out of it. And then I was like, okay, that's kind of a cheap ploy.
Yeah, as much as I was hyped for the Morpheus Neo reunion, I wasn't really crazy about that scene either. Mostly because I feel like Lawrence Fishburne was probably on set for a day didn't read his lines and just decided, I'm going to have fun with this. And yeah, I thought he was kind of just overacting. Wasn't really a big fan.
Yeah, because they were like, he was embodying the meme, maybe more so. He was embodying, it was like he was trying to maintain that dynamic that they once had. And when you try to just simply reproduce something, sometimes it comes off as a little bit superficial.
Yeah. Do you think they're going to do a different Keanu Reeves reunion in the third one? Like
Alex Winter?
Patrick Dempsey.
You've seen the
Wait, is it Patrick? Who?
Sandra Bullock?
The White House one, yeah. Sandra Bullock, that's the Speed reunion.
Speed, oh, right. Yeah. Right.
It would be a way to inject a little bit of levity into it. I think it is nice. Now that you've mentioned the Buster Keaton thing, I can't get out of now thinking of the film through that lens as being just this amazing expression of physical comedy, physical performance. Because even when he gets shot and he's like lumbering through the club and stuff like that, we talked about this before, he doesn't like, I mean, yeah, he's still superhuman. He takes a beating that is not what a normal body can take, but he at least, they aim at showing that he's affected physically by this, right? And he like leans over and he's like limping, but nevertheless, when it's time to initiate contact, he still beats the shit out of people. And so there is an element that they're being very aware of the physical aspects. And I think that does kind of change the way that I think about the movie now. Like I kind of want to watch it again now and just think about Buster Keaton, Jackie Chan, John Wick. And see how that changes my viewing experience.
I really recommend that when the third one comes out, you see it in a theater, because it's all, I think in general, when you're in a community of a lot of people, that kind of collective effervescence makes comedy a bit more effective. And then if just one person catches on to the comedy and starts laughing, it really infects the rest of the crowd. And I think John Wick movies are best seen in a crowd because there are like sporadic laughs throughout these badass action sequences.
Yeah. Do you guys have a favorite, like either kill or just little action sequence?
I mean, for me, when he's in the underground lair after Santino's sister kills herself and he's got those three guns planted and one of them is like an automatic shotgun.
Yeah.
And then he pins a guy with the nozzle or the tip of the shotgun and then just pulls a fucking a bullet out of his pocket, reloads,
that's
and
amazing.
Just shoots him in the stomach. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Just seeing Keanu Reeves deal with like three guns, you know, shoot one out until there's no more bullets left in the clip, throw the gun to the side, pick up one that's even more badass, and then that goes again. So good.
I love the one where he just chunks the gun at the guy's face, and then he takes out a pistol and shoots him in the head.
Yeah.
I like, remember, so it's the one we talked about it in the first episode or about the first film, and I don't remember which scene it is, but it's something like he's shooting his gun and he has to reload so that he can finish shooting the guy in the head or something,
right?
Like that.
Yeah.
And he does one in this one, and it's in the club, I think. He like pulls the guy's hair down over the barrel and then shoots upwards.
Oh,
do you remember?
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
I that's one of those ones where I looked away, Ryan, because I think you mentioned that. I was like, oh, Jesus. You know?
Yeah.
If you were in the theater, I think you would have looked away, and then when everyone else is laughing, you would have started chuckling a little bit.
And yeah. It's not a... it's not a gun kill, but when they're in the warehouse and then he just like sideswipes that dude and it makes him with his car and it makes him, you know, like first the impact is so crazy and then they don't cut and it's, you see him hitting a beam and falling on the ground. And
yeah.
I've seen that in movies for the last several years where they don't cut and you're just, which gives it this insane effect. I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's obviously computers, but it seems seamless. It seems like a guy should not be alive.
Yeah.
Who did that stunt?
All right, now we're moving on to our segment where we have a conversation with one of our patrons. If you guys would also like to become a patron, check out wisecrackplus.com, and you yourselves can be on the podcast. So today we've got Mauricio from Argentina.
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Welcome. Thanks for coming, dude.
Thank you for supporting us. It really means a lot. Thank you for coming to hang out with us. First question, have you seen John Wick or John Wick 2, and what do you think about them?
Yeah, I was actually working at a cinema when John Wick 2 came out.
Oh, hell
and,
yeah.
And I had no clue what it was. I saw the poster and I was just like, this has got to be some bullshit right there. I'm serious. That was the first thing I thought about John Wick. I didn't know what it was, and I thought it was going to be really bad.
Were you not a Keanu Reeves fan?
No, I've been a Keanu Reeves fan my whole life, and that's actually what worried me about seeing the poster, because, you know, it's been a really long time since The Matrix, and I didn't know what was going on. And then all of a sudden, in 1 year, I find out about two movies. Do you guys see The Whole Truth?
No.
No, what's that?
That's a Netflix. Well, it's not a Netflix. I think it was in theaters also, but I think you can see it on Netflix. It's a movie about Keanu Reeves. He plays I don't know if he's a pro bono lawyer or something.
Huh.
I haven't seen it anyway. It doesn't matter. But yeah, so I was just like, okay, I kind of got like that Nicolas Cage feeling in the back of my head. Like, you like, know what I mean?
Like Bangkok Dangerous or something stupid like that.
Like, no, like, you know, just like Ghost Rider-ish yeah. feeling, like just really bad movies coming out of nowhere.
Did you like it when you finally see it?
Oh, yeah, it was fucking amazing. Yeah, it was really fucking good.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. So I wanted to spend this time just to kind of get an idea. I want the people to kind of hear what our listeners are like and kind of just get them to know you. So, and since it's a movie podcast, I want to kind of do that through the lens of movies. So my second question to you is there ever been a movie that changed the way you looked at the world? And if so, what movie was it?
Oh, I actually, I read about this question in, Jesus Christ, you gotta, there's one movie you gotta watch. And, I don't know if you guys have seen, The Congress.
Who's in that?
Congress. Is that a...
That's with Robin Wright?
Yeah.
I have seen that movie.
That movie is, like, just bananas. Like, if anybody hearing here this that hasn't seen it, do not even, like, watch the trailer. You just have to watch that movie.
Well, can I not spoil the kind of overall visual conceit? It's like...
Yeah, sure.
It's, like, half animated. And then the second half.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. This was a fantastic fest.
Did you see it?
I did not see it, but I remember hearing all about it. Yes. Yeah, so you loved it, huh? It blew your mind. It worked for you.
No, it's just like the whole like second act is so abstract, and you're like, this is some bullshit. I can't believe I'm still watching this. And then the ending, just like, you're like, oh my God, how could I have been so stupid? This is actually happening, and you know, you kind of get that feeling like this is kind of like the real world, but, you know.
The movie...
It's really messed. It's actually... I started crying. That's like really sad, really, really good movie.
If I remember correctly, I have seen this movie. The movie is mostly about Robin Wright dealing with... Basically, the movie is like her expression of what it was like.
I'm sorry, I have seen this. She plays herself.
Yeah,
right?
And it's her...
She plays herself, yeah.
Yeah.
It's her dealing with being a objectivized actress... after The Princess Bride and losing all her fame and realizing that people just want her for her beauty, right?
Yeah, something they talk like about that. Forrest Gump and stuff,
right?
Like, in it, yeah. I saw this way after Fantastic Fest. That's why I didn't remember it. But yeah, I did not love that movie, but I definitely can see it. Like once it gets to the very end, it does do a really good job of kind of twisting your expectations. I feel like.
It's really cool. I compare it to John Wick in the sense that John Wick is a lot, let's be honest, is a lot simpler film, but you know, I just love the fact that there is no hand holding at all. Yeah. And I've only watched it once. I swear to God, I've only watched it once. You know, I love the small roles, the cameos and some of the actors like Paul Giamatti. Really fucking cool to see them again. And it's a real shame that movie flopped, like for real. Like nobody knows about that movie. I've never even heard of it. I saw it by accident. It's based on it's loosely based on a book called The Futurological Congress.
Yeah, Austin, you need to see that, dude. You would love it. Yeah. It's a wank fest and a half.
Did you ever see Waltz with Bashir, Austin?
God, no.
Okay, it's by the. It's you like guys, the so, same
you,
animation.
You guys are gonna
style.
Remember me. You're gonna be like Jesus Christ. It's just bananas.
All right, but my next question is, what do you think is the most relevant movie in the world right now, or more specifically, what's the most relevant movie to your life? What movie speaks to what you see around the world right now, or what you see in your life?
That answer is unfortunately going to suck really bad.
Oh, you're don't worry. Like let's it. Hear it.
Well, Infinity War, obviously.
Okay. Yeah. Go on.
Unfortunately. I say unfortunately, and I don't mean it. Why is he cheering? Is he cheering because he thinks I'm going to say it sucks?
No. Why are you cheering, Ryan?
No, I just think that's a good movie, and I can see that. You know, we've invested 15 years of our lives of pop culture-ness into that movie. So I can see that culminating to be in the most relevant movie.
It's everywhere, man. I can't get away from it. I wake up in the morning, I listen to podcasts, I watch YouTube. The only things I get anymore are these freaking discussions and what's coming up next. And it's just, I'm living in Marvel right now, unfortunately. that's what fucking pisses me off. You know,
yeah,
I really love the movie and, you know, most of the Marvel movies, but I almost feel like this is like my whole life. I've just been in like this Disney test tube. You know what I mean? I grew up with animated shit.
That's such a good way to put it.
With animated movies with Disney, Lion King, Toy Story. And now I'm older and Disney bought everything that I ever cared about. I'm really scared.
Amazing. That's so true, man. So, what? I guess
really sad.
If that's, I mean, what do you think is going to happen? And the second one, what's your best guess? Educated guess? Are those characters going to come back, and how?
Well, you know, the big news right now is how all of their contracts are starting to expire, and Chris Evans at least.
Chris Evans just finished. He just finished. He said it was I think it was the last time that he played that he plays that character.
So. He's done. He's wrapping. He wrapped up at Avengers 4 and he's done, man. He's probably done now, going to theater or something.
But don't you think a tweet like that, don't you think a tweet like that is just a good bargaining technique? You know, it's like,
he really doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, it saved his career. Cause let's be honest, the guy, he's a great guy, but, his only big thing was, you know, he couldn't even pull off being a superhero before with, what is this movie called?
Oh, Fantastic Four.
Right. Fantastic Four. He's just so stupid in that movie. I was like, this is a cringy ass actor. And then he pulled off, Captain America and he's been like, you know, a sensation since then.
See, I think my buddy and I talk about this, about how like some guys are just too good looking sometimes to be taken seriously as actors. And like Chris Pine is one of those guys. So what you got to do is you got to give him a beard and a hat. And when you give him a beard and a hat, like you can do with Chris Pine and you can do it with Chris Evans too. Like in Snowpiercer, give him a beanie, give him a beard.
Make him dirty.
He can do a serious role. Cause he's actually, I think that Chris Evans, he's come a long way from Not Another Teen Movie acting days. Right.
I like
I
movie.
Actually think he's a very good actor. It's just, you got to get him the
funny.
Right role.
He was funny. He was funny in Not Another Teen Movie, but the only reason
he was cheesy.
Right. But it's okay. Yeah, I give him a pass. I watched Not Another Teen Movie the other night, like a few months ago or a few weeks ago. And, it's actually good. It's a funny movie. You know, and he does a good job. It's just that now that he's Captain America, it's like we look back and he's like, oh, it's Chris Evans. You know, I didn't know who he was before.
I know, right. But I think that this is like, I think it's like the perfect time. If he does get out, this is like the perfect time for him to go into his, I'm going to be taken seriously as an actor now. So I'm going to have a scruffy face and wear a hat and I'm going to do like serious roles with John Hillcoat or something like that. You know,
I could see him eventually like getting a nomination or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. This is, he's got.
Hey,
that,
but you know, speaking of actors getting breaks, I'm really excited about Captain Marvel. Like Brie Larson is the shit. I loved her in Room, and my girlfriend is absolutely in love with Brie Larson. I saw her in Community. I didn't even know who she was. That's another example of someone like that's gonna get a lot of rep. You know, after their big AAA movie, I really like Brie Larson. I think she's gonna pull it off.
I missed Room, but I remember Ryan telling me it's great.
Oh, dude, yeah. Don't read anything about it.
Okay.
Yeah, don't read anything about it. I think we should do it on the podcast. Fuck, we should do it next week.
Okay.
I actually hate those movies that go in for the shock value. But yeah, she does a good job. It's a good movie.
All right. So you live in Argentina. What are Argentinian movies like? Are there any famous Argentinian movies that we may have seen or may have heard of?
Wild Tales, baby.
Oh, is that from Argentina?
Wild Tales.
That's my one. That was my favorite movie.
Dude, me and Ryan saw that movie together. We loved it.
I've been actually like a little bit like practicing this one because I am actually not a big Argentinian film fan, and any Argentinians hearing me are gonna like come knocking at my door tomorrow and kick my ass. Because we have this thing, like you have to praise, you know, national stuff, but I have a lot of things against it, you know, what the stuff that happens here.
You mean just the movies that come out you don't happen to like?
Yeah, what don't you like about them?
No, they are amazing movies. Nine Queens, here's two examples that I'll give you. There's a movie here called Nueve Reinas, which is Nine Queens. Okay. The movie is with Ricardo Darín, the same one from Wild Tales and the second one I'm about to mention.
Hell yeah.
The movie came out in 2000. It was like, got like 24 bullshit nominations. It was a really good movie here. It was really important. Yeah. And then they made an American adaptation. It's just called Criminal. And it's with this guy. Oh my God. Criminal. I wrote his name down because I couldn't remember it. You guys know who John C. Reilly is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Adult Swim guy. Well, no, I always knew him as the Adult Swim guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I always know him as Chess Brockman from Boogie Nights.
He's like really important. He's a really important dude. And he does the main protagonist in that movie. And then you also have Diego Luna. And that's about it. So then basically any like decent movie that you've ever heard about from Argentina pretty much got an adaptation later to American film. Mm-hmm. Like The Secret in Their Eyes, for example.
Yes.
With this one guy, I don't want to slaughter his name. He's this black guy from Doctor Strange. What was the yeah, you'll never get it.
He was I know who you're talking character. About. I know the character you're talking about. I don't know the guy's name.
He's the one who pops up in the post credits and kills the guy.
Right, because he's possessed or something.
He's gonna be the bad guy in the second one probably. Right. Anyway, he does Ricardo Darín's part in so Ricardo Darín's like this really important actor here. He's like one of the, like maybe the top five actors, and you know what pisses me off, the top 10 movies ever, that's that guy. So that's the world I live in. Okay. You know, and
it's just a lot the same dude.
Yeah, it's the same fucking dude. That's the thing. It's like there's no actors here. You know, there's a comedy actor, there's a really important, you know, suspense actor, thriller actor. And
this is one of the tough struggles that you get in the international market, is that everyone thinks, and to an extent they're right, they have to leave wherever they're from and go to Hollywood. You know, like I just watched Blade Runner 2049 last night, and I was thinking about Ana de Armas. You know, she's Cuban, but she has to go to Hollywood to make it. I lived in England, I lived in Scotland, I lived in Ireland, and I spent a lot of time in Spain. And when you're in the entertainment industry there, all of them talk about how they can't wait to get to Hollywood. They can't wait to get out. And the shitty thing is it saps the local industry and the talent away from those regional areas. And so when they try to build, like Scotland is really trying to build up their entertainment industry, and you get the same thing in the UK. The problem is the UK has London, and that's powerful, but even still, everyone gets sucked out of there, so all the talent leaves and they go to fucking LA, you know?
Well, this guy should have taken a break. What he actually said in an interview that he was gonna be cast in Too Fast, Too Furious, because they wanted an Argentinian bad guy, you know, the one on the yacht with the drugs and shit, and he refused because he was tired of the typical Latino trope of drug dealing bad guys.
Kingpins, yeah.
Basically, you wouldn't have seen him on Breaking Bad or anything like that.
Right.
Has he done a lot of English speaking roles or no?
No, never. He's always refused. This is like a fucking.
He's an Argentinian purist here.
Like the equivalent to an Oscar. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's like, nah, well, I'm not gonna.
He doesn't need that validation.
Yeah. He's like, I'm big over here, my home country.
So what movie are you looking forward to most?
Aside from anything Marvel, Jesus.
It could be
Marvel. I don't even know what's going on anymore.
I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I mean, I'm looking forward to obviously John Wick 3.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah, obviously John Wick 3. But what I mean is I only go to the theater like 2 or 3 times a year, and it's probably for Marvel related things.
First Man.
I went to see Deadpool 2, and I was like, "No, what am I doing here? Why did I pay so much to watch this movie?"
They don't got movie pass down in Argentina?
Huh?
Do you guys have movie pass down there? Is that a thing, or was it a thing?
No. I have to take a bus, and I have to go to another city to do like one of the movie theaters. And you know, it's okay if you go alone. It's no problem. But you want to take the whole family. It's a thing. You have to plan it accordingly. Right.
The movie really better.
We watched Infinity War, and then like the next week I went to see Deadpool 2, and I was like, I wanted to watch Infinity War again.
I hear you.
Well, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. It's just I think one of you guys said it once about Marvel movies. It's like this. It would be okay on a streaming service like what's kind of happening now with Hulu. Like, you know, most of the movies they're good quality. It's just it's going to reach a point where it's just like the standard isn't going to be. Isn't going to always be reached, so they're not going to want to put everything in theaters anymore. That's my theory.
Oh yeah,
and that's going to be good for the rest of us because fucking Disney doesn't let you. Disney had like cuts deals with people so that like, I don't know how it is that like you can't on opening night, or like I don't know during how many weeks they can only screen like, they'll only give the movie to theaters like. If they have a certain amount of what are they called, like the rooms you go in to watch the movies?
Yeah, certain amount of screens.
They do that
exactly.
They do that here. There are times where if there's like a big screen, like a dome or an IMAX screen, they'll basically if there's a Star Wars movie coming out or something, Disney will say if you're not playing this movie all month, we're not going to give it to you at all, and it causes
exactly.
A big shitstorm.
And here it's three times worse because you have three variations of the same movie. So when Infinity War came out, you'll have the dubbed in Spanish version, the dubbed in English with subtitles version, and then the 3D variations of both of those. So there are four screenings for the same movie. Oh, and then the 4D. The one with the...
Fucking love 4D. Jared, I want to hear your...
The wind that blows in your face?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Speaking of 4D, my most anticipated movie of this year is Alita Battle Angel.
In 4D.
In 4DX, baby. James Cameron, Robert Rodriguez, 4DX. Are you shitting me?
It sounds like a cool theme park ride.
Yeah, exactly. Slash movie.
Oh, my God.
All right, last question. What do you think is the worst movie ever made or the worst movie you've seen?
The worst movie I've seen... Do documentaries count? Like, sure. Not like those fake ass reality documentary movies that actors make sometimes.
Anything.
Okay, let's see if you got this one. I used to be a Pauly Shore fan.
Go on.
Hold on. So this guy, the story is that one time he was he heard from some person that. You know, you could go to Africa. Does anybody know about this? He made a documentary movie where he goes to Africa to adopt a child.
Pauly Shore does?
Pauly Shore. Okay. And then it turns into this weird thing where it looks like Pauly Shore is like hanging out with, like the whole thing looks like he's just coked out and hanging out with hookers. And like, he's got like this cringy, like, dub of him over the movie like narrating the adventures, and then he's got all these poor African people like acting for him.
God,
like it's really really bad. You gotta look into, I don't remember how it's called, look into Pauly Shore.
It's called Adopted.
Look into his filmography. That, yeah, and it's really sad because there's actually this like this really authentic part where he's talking to these people in this town. And he says, like, they're like, why do you want to adopt a kid? And he's like, well, you know, I want to give him an opportunity. You know, I want to take him with me, and I want to give him a better life. And one of the guys is just looking at him. He's like, why do you think your life is better? And I was like, I was surprised. I was like, yeah, who is this guy? You know,
I mean, in fairness, I think he's taking the piss out of like you know, like when Hollywood celebrities go to Africa and they
like Madonna or yeah. Angelina Jolie.
I don't think he pulled it off. Like, if you're trying to say like he was like doing it like ironically to be like as a satire, he didn't pull it off very well.
He completely failed.
It was really insulting. It was really really insulting. Piece of crap. And my sister caught me watching it, and she was like, "What is this?" And I was just like, "I don't know." I was watching Biodome, and then all of a sudden this. You know, I used to have this thing where I would go through an actor's entire filmography, you know?
Oh, hell yeah. I was interested in them.
And that's how you know if you're a fan or not, you know? Like, for example, I agree with Jared on a lot of things, you know? Like, I know you're a big Nolan fan, and I was obsessed with Nolan just about as much as I was obsessed with Keanu Reeves at one point. But then I watched his filmography in chronological order, and I realized that I wasn't, you know what I mean? Like,
really?
Memento's great.
I had the opposite experience. I was like, I dug him, and then I watched the filmography in order, and I was like, this guy's fucking genius.
Oh, yeah, he's great. It's just his formula is so laid out that at one point, it's just like, I'm about to give Interstellar another chance because I just, you know, it's been a long time, but
yeah.
For me, it's Inception, Dark Knight, and Dark Knight Rises. Like, that time when we were in the theater with Dark Knight Rises, the whole theater was silent. We were like 100 people fucking thought Batman was dead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That shit was amazing. But, anyway, I got off track, though. What I meant to say was, the Pauly Shore movie, definitely.
Well, I'm just going to end on this. This is actually bonkers that you brought up Pauly Shore, because there's a guy who used to work for us who is now Pauly Shore's assistant, and he is Xavier. He called us and he was like, dude, I can probably get Pauly Shore on the podcast.
I didn't know you were going to bring that up or not.
Yeah, I didn't know if we were supposed to announce it. I was going to be like,
well, it's not confirmed yet, so I don't want to say anything.
Do you want to cut that out?
Well, what do you think? Do you think we should cut it out because it would be too awesome just to all of a sudden upload?
I just said for about 5 minutes about how he was coked out and
he'll probably show up coked out.
War with Pauly Shore in 2018.
I'm telling you, I actually wanted to meet the guy at one time, but I just spent 5 minutes saying that he was probably on a cocaine binge.
But he's not going to deny that. That's a fact.
I think we should save the announcement.
Okay. All right. Well, for you, we're going to make it happen, because I was like, I don't know. So wait, before we go, if we do get him on the podcast, what movie do you want us to do? Because we want to do a Pauly Shore movie, but which one should we do?
Oh, Jesus.
Biodome or Encino Man, right?
Son-in-law.
Jury duty.
Oh, no. You know what you can do? You guys are going to hate me. Do fucking Andy Wexler. What's the name of that movie with Adam Sandler where he calls everybody to do the movie with him? It's like the Infinity War of Adam Sandler movies.
Oh, you're talking about like Grown Ups?
Sandy Wexler.
Sandy Wexler. Yeah.
Well, he's a cameo in this movie. I want you to ask.
I'll ask him about it, but what's a movie that he starred in?
There's only a handful, Jared. There's only like 10 of them.
I guess we'll do.
And there's only about two that anyone has seen and are good.
So Encino Man and
Biodome. You know, Son-in-Law is a runner-up, distant runner-up.
Okay.
You know, Pauly Shore is dead.
He was a voice in the Goofy movie.
Oh, fuck yeah. I love that movie. We'll definitely ask him about that. Okay. There is that movie, Pauly Shore is Dead.
He was the Leaning Tower of Cheese.
That's him? That's him?
He plays like the cool sidekick guy?
Oh, dude. No way.
That's Pauly Shore.
Right, the Leaning Tower of Cheese.
It's amazing that we all know the Goofy movie.
Yeah.
Wow. And he has the great question in Extremely Goofy Movie, which is, why do we all wear gloves?
And does he get an answer? Oh, man. Awesome.
All right. Well, Mauricio, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Thank you for supporting us on Patreon, man. It really means a lot. It's been great talking to you.
Go feed that dog.
Thanks, man. Ciao.
Yeah, dude, Mauricio, you're awesome, man. That was a fun conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to go watch Adopted pretty much tonight.
Adopted. Go watch it. Go watch it, please. In HD.
All right, Mauricio, take it easy, man.
All right, cool. Take care.
We are the real Brady Bros. Brady Brothers from the TV show Brady Bunch. I'm Barry Williams.
And I'm Christopher Knight.
I played Greg. And who were you again?
I played Peter. We've decided that we're going to do a podcast around episodes of the Brady Bunch. We're going to use it as a prism to look back to our experience doing the show and why the Brady Bunch is still popular.
Have a sunshine day.
We are the real Brady Bros.
All right, guys, I think we should move into the mailbag.
Let's do
Ryan,
it.
Ryan, I think I got some questions printed out for Ryan. All right. Before we get into that, I want to give everyone a reminder that if you want to leave us a voicemail, thoughts, questions, insights, comments, whatever you guys want, number is 213-534-8807. But without further ado, Ryan, do you want to read some questions?
Yeah. So we got some good Mad Max questions. And just little points. So this guy named Steven says, the musician Iota played the Doof Warrior, the guitarist from Mad Max Fury Road.
The guy
with the homemade flame-throwing guitar. So I got to go look up who Iota is. He scored his own music, and his backstory was that Immortan Joe found Doof with his dead mother. So Joe brought him back to the Citadel and raised him with the war pups. And then Doof wears his mother's face as a mask so he would never forget her.
Does it say in the email where he's getting this from?
I think this is like from interviews and stuff.
Oh.
I mean, so yeah, hopefully this is correct. I assume it's on the
internet.
Because
we were wondering what the origins are for something so insane and awesome as the guy with the guitar with a flamethrower at the end who has a indiscernible, bizarre-looking face.
Right.
So yeah, thank you for that,
Steven. He's an Australian musician, so that kind of makes a lot of sense. And yeah, apparently he is the dude, the Doof Warrior.
The Doof. Okay, that's amazing. You looked it up. Awesome. All right, man. Thanks, Steven. All right. So David wrote in about our Borat episode.
Which I was not here for.
Right, you weren't here for. But we were, perplexed. Or I think I talked about how I was confused the first time I saw it with the Pamela Anderson kidnapping scene.
Yeah.
It's just like it comes out of nowhere. And he wanted to inform us that he said, hey, gang, just wanted to share with you some info on the attempted kidnapping scene at the end of Borat, which I think some of you found a bit jarring. In Kazakhstan, there is actually a tradition of kidnapping the bride, sack over the head and all. This was traditionally if the families involved were unable to afford the typical exchange of money between families and other costs which are involved in a more typical wedding. The somewhat staged kidnapping of the bride was a way of avoiding a degree of shame and embarrassment associated with admitting to poverty while still allowing the couple to marry. Though a quick Google search does suggest this tradition is sometimes abused. So this apparently bizarre into a bizarre film is actually a surprisingly genuine nod to an aspect of Kazakhstan culture.
That's crazy. I definitely thought that this was another joke in the whole Borat thing of, oh, the whole joke is that Eastern Europe or whatever that side of the world is just so foreign to Americans who only speak one language and have a very myopic view of culture that we can get them to believe that it's a legitimate anything is a legitimate cultural tradition in that other part of the world.
Right.
But it's a real thing. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, I think that symbolically, it's practiced sometimes by some cultures today. From like tiny bits that I've heard in like anthropological studies, but it's generally viewed as highly problematic.
Do we have a sound for that?
even by those culture standards today, but they practice it as like a symbolic gesture to the traditions of the past and things like that. But yeah, no.
So you're saying in modern Kazakhstan, you inform your wife that I really want to.
I'm gonna
kidnap you tomorrow just to.
It's like
do justice
it's like, you guys
to
ever
our
on,
cultural
like,
customs.
Sports teams or anything like that in high school, and they like tell your parents that they're gonna initiate you by kidnapping you,
yeah.
And then at midnight you don't know about it, but your parents let them in your room and they kidnap you.
Yeah, we did that. Except my parents are really bad at keeping a secret.
You did okay. that? I'd never.
Well, I got kidnapped. I didn't really? Kidnap someone. I did.
Jesus
yeah.
Christ, Jared.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's basically just like a bunch of people that you go to school with that have never seen you in your room before just come in your room and wake you up, except I knew it was coming, so oh. I was awake, and I had to pretend
Lame.
To be asleep.
Yeah, see, I didn't know. It happened to me a couple of times. Neither time. My mom, she was all into that shit, man. So thanks for the trauma.
You've both been kidnapped, huh? Interesting. So these were some comments in our live chat here.
Okay.
This Brian D says, my favorite scene of the movie is when John Wick time travels to write his history report.
Hell yeah, and he gets Napoleon and Sigmund Freud and Abraham Lincoln and Genghis yeah. Khan. Yeah, yeah, I like that one too.
That was a good scene in that movie.
God, I cannot wait for Bill and Ted 3. I don't know what the plot is going to be, but I don't really want to know until I'm sitting there in the theater. But they better make it awesome.
They've had the plot for a while. It's circulated on the internet, and so you can actually see what it's about. It should be interesting.
Okay, cool.
I'm for it.
Rolf Ransom said an oath is an oath is an oath about when we're talking about blood oaths.
That's true.
I agree, yeah. Rolf. Princess Rippy thinks John Wick is about love and forgiveness.
Mm. Forgiveness. Yeah. Interesting.
It's about these people
I'd
like to hear more. Like have like a very methodical way of forgiveness. It's like there's a whole process of it. You will be forgiven if you do this, this, and
well,
this.
That's an interesting thing that I'm curious is if there is some sort of holy, not often talked about way that John Wick can redeem himself in the eyes of the Continental or something like that. You know, like there's only one way to reinsert yourself and recommunicate yourself in the Continental, but it is an ancient way that nobody has ever done. I can see something like that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, because they do talk about eye for an eye. Right.
At
a certain point in the second one. I don't know if they do in the first one, but they definitely mention it at this point. And because I am really interested in the idea of justice and what is justice, this is something that I think about. So if it's a film that aims at forgiveness, it's a film that complicates it and says that, well, maybe less about forgiveness and more it's a film about justice, we should say. But the idea is that justice can only be carried out by, you know, it's like Gandhi says, eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. It's about escalation. It's about, okay, well, we have this oath. You must do this thing for me because I did this thing for you. So it's a one-to-one quantified measure of equivalence. And then, well, you just killed my sister. Therefore, now I must act in an appropriate manner because, again, that's the rules of equivalency. And so there's this law of justice that undercuts or that seems to condition this underground world. But the question is, can you have a different type of justice? And that's what breaks the cycle so that it doesn't just simply repeat. And maybe that's what that ancient tradition will do. Like that's where Jesus comes in. That's the Jesus myth or the Osiris myth or various other, the sacrificial lamb, right? Rene Girard talks about the idea of the scapegoat. That's where those things come in because they break that cycle of mimetic repetition that just endlessly reproduces punitivity or retribution. And you get to a different type of justice, something that can break that circular endless cycle of violence. So maybe
I think that would be cool, but I have a feeling it's probably going to end a lot like the first one in that John Wick is almost dead, has flashbacks of the wife that he loved, somehow pulls through, and then I'm sure something reaffirming with the dog, the end.
I think John Wick's going to defeat the President of the United States, who is a murderer. He's going to get the keys to the United States Treasury, pay off every assassin not to kill anymore, and make world peace, the end.
You're missing a dog element. He's going to adopt every dog in every pound in America.
Yes, exactly. Right. And then let them free.
last comment.
Jesso. Jesso says, John Wick would never break a pinky promise. But he did.
He didn't. I mean, he ended up doing it.
He ended up doing it. And then she also said...
He said, don't do this. You're going to regret it.
Yeah.
I think he regretted it.
He did. And then Jesso also said, is that a tiny little pumpkin on our desk? That's what makes this a live cast.
That's right.
This is I didn't even realize that. We have a decorative pumpkin for Halloween.
For Halloween.
Good job, production design crew.
That's right. Speaking of which, Halloween show, October 26th with the Funhouse Dudes, 10 p.m. in L.A. We'll let you guys know about tickets. Our voicemails, 213-534-8807. And before we sign off, quickly, what movie are we doing next week, guys? First of all,
Troopers.
Austin, have you seen Sorry to Bother You yet?
No, so check this. So Boots Riley just tweeted out that it is coming to Australia like ASAP. So they, because they couldn't get international distribution. And then he went online to try to get people on Twitter and Facebook and wherever else to support kind of getting or stimulating buzz around international distribution to kind of get the attention of distributors. And apparently it worked. So now it's got a UK and an Australian distributor, and it should be coming out ASAP.
Okay, well, for those of you who are patrons at wisecrackplus.com, hit us up on the Discord server. Let us know what you want us to do next week, because right now it's wide open. And then the week after that, Alec is actually going to be here, and he really wants to do Fight Club. But
where can we find you on the internet, Jared?
So, you can find me on the internet at wisecrackstuff. What about you, Ryan?
You can find me at Ryan Shorts and Ryan's Game Show on YouTube and Facebook. I'm releasing a PSA, a call to action, tomorrow for all Ryan Haley's on YouTube. There's a bunch of us out there.
Oh.
And we need to bind together, unionize, and really, you know, all subscribe to each other's channels. So
I thought you were a libertarian.
What? you have own free will. No one's compelling you to join our union.
Okay. And Austin?
Yeah, hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn that you can check out. And if anyone wants to do a deep dive into Sartre, mark it on your calendars that July of 2019 is when my book will be out. So.
Oh, marked. Calendars marked.
Marked. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Peace.
Show me the money!
Goodbye from Hollywood, California!
Later.